From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action. It is my privilege to be sitting in for Tony today. We have lots on the agenda, as we always do during a busy week in Washington. Up first today, I'll address the watered-down resolution that the House Democrats crafted after Democratic Muslim Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota made a particularly awful statement last week. My guest is Mort Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America, who is downright furious with both the Congresswoman and with the spineless Democrats. In my second segment, Alabama attorney Brett Helms joins me to discuss a precedent-setting lawsuit as he is suing an abortion mill on behalf of not only the father who opposed his girlfriend's abortion, but on behalf of the dead baby's estate. Alabama, 4 months ago, recognized the personhood of the child in the womb, and we'll talk about how that's implicated in this lawsuit next. At the bottom of the hour, an elderly widow who has led a Bible study in California Veterans Home is being told to shut it down and even being threatened with eviction. My guest will be her attorney, Brad Dacus, president of the Pacific Justice Institute. And at 42 past the hour, California parents are hot under the collar about a new sex ed curriculum that is both inappropriate and pornographic. I will talk to Rebecca Friedrichs, a former California educator for 28 years, who agrees with their concerns. Rebecca has written a book entitled Standing Up to Goliath, Battling State and National Teachers Unions for the Heart and Soul of Our Kids and Country. As always, you can find out more about the guests and find the podcast of today's program at tonyperkins.com. You can also follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins and me on Twitter at Sarah P. Perry. Well, first up, my guest is Mort Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America, and I'm particularly happy to be talking to him today because last week, Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota made anti-Semitic remarks in describing the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, a pro-Israel lobbying organization. She had this to say, quote, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. I want to ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA or fossil fuel industries or big pharma and not talk about a powerful lobbying group that is influencing policy? To talk about this ugly example of anti-Semitism and what he calls a toothless congressional resolution addressing it is Mort Klein. Mort, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's great to be with you and to have so many serious Christians listening in.
Thank you. Well, Mort, when you heard Representative Omar make these anti-Semitic comments, and this was not the first time, by the way, because back in 2012, for those who have not been particularly closely following some of her commentary, she did tweet in 2012 that Israel has, quote, hypnotized the world. Now, she tweeted this back in 2012, but went on to say, may Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel. So this most recent comment, when she made it, tell me exactly how you were feeling.
Well, it is really extraordinary to see for the first time in my lifetime in America to see overt Jew hatred and Israel hatred, Israel bashing, the likes of which I've never seen in all the years that I've been alive living here in the United States of America. By the way, the statements have been made by who I call the three musketeers. This Representative Omar of Minnesota, Representative Tlaib of Michigan, and Representative AOC, that's Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Omar, of course, has used Zionist-like statements. The Jews are evil. As you said, the Jews hypnotize the world. The Jews massacre innocent Arabs. Jewish money controls Congress. You know, it's interesting. She says Jewish money is what's controlling Congress. How is it that the polls show that by 60-20, Americans support Israel over the Palestinian Arabs? Are we paying all of these people throughout the United States? The reason Congress supports Israel is because Americans, especially American Christians, support Israel. That has nothing to do with lobbying whatsoever. And, you know, she also, of course, as you mentioned, condemned Israel, Jews, of being dual loyalists. Why can't a Jew, first of all, love America and love Israel? Why can't an Italian love Italy and love America? It's ridiculous. There's no conflict between Israel and America. We're not going to war against America. But she ignored, madam, the fact that her compatriot, Representative Tlaib, when she was inducted as a congresswoman a few weeks ago, she wrapped herself in a Palestinian Authority terrorist regime flag.
Yes, she did.
Is this what an American congresswoman should do? Why didn't Omar talk about her true dual loyalty by being loyal to a terrorist regime who hates America, won't talk to America? And by the way, she not only ignores this, she publicly supports the Maduro, the communist cruel dictatorship of Venezuela. She demands no sanctions and that we should be friendly with this vicious regime.
Yes,
so
she
this
does.
Is somebody who's an anti-patriot, a clear anti-Semite, and it is so troubling that that this resolution was all prompted by the awful anti-Semitic statements made by these three congresswomen, and yet they watered it down to include all sorts of hatred against other groups. It's okay to have such a resolution, but that should be separate. This resolution should have been only about Israel and Jews. And in fact, this resolution never mentions any of these three anti-Semites, never condemns them, never talks about their Israel bashing. It was really just a disgrace. As a Jewish American, and I think all Americans, are really frightened to see that the Democratic Party is refusing to condemn anti-Semitism in a way where these women would never make these types of statements again. It's a frightening time in America, I'm afraid.
It is. It is. And during language negotiations, there was a bit of a last minute scuffle, as we anticipated, because the Democrats do control the House. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was in damage control mode. So we have audio of what she said the day before the resolution passed. Listen to this.
It's up to her to explain, but I do not believe that she understood the full weight of the words. I feel confident that her words were not based on any anti-Semitic attitude, but that she didn't have a full appreciation of how they landed on other people, where these words have a history and a cultural impact that might have been unknown to her.
So subsequently, Representative Omar said there is a difference between criticism of a country, criticism of an administration and the government, and a criticism of the people and their faith. So you and I know that's not the case. But for those listening, can you tell us how you react to that?
Well, first of all, not only has she said that these people are not anti-Semites, Steny Hoyer, her deputy, said the same thing. Three of the Democratic candidates have supported Omar, this anti-Semite. That's Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Liz Warren of Massachusetts have all praised and supported her. And Pelosi took a picture with them and put herself on the front cover of Rolling Stone magazine. As opposed to condemning her and isolating her, she embraces her and praises her and legitimizes her. What this is saying to me is that the Democratic Party is becoming Corbynized, meaning they're becoming like the Labour Party of England, which is extreme left-wing socialist communist with enormous hatred toward Israel and the Jewish state. I see the Democratic Party going in that direction. I've seen virtually no Democrats coming out and condemning these people by name and making it clear that there's no place for this type of hatred against Jews in the United States of America. And by the way, they support the Palestinian Authority with all their heart and soul. The Palestinian Authority, which has driven out the Christians from Bethlehem in the last 25 years. Bethlehem used to be 80% Christian. It's now 10% Christian. Eastern Jerusalem, there was very large numbers of Christians living in Eastern Jerusalem. Under their control from 48 to 67, they drove out most of them. Churches under Arab rule cannot build. They are forced Christians to learn the Koran. The only place where Christians are growing in numbers in the Middle East is in Israel. So I feel a closeness to American Christians, having the same values and the same policy beliefs as the Jewish people, for the most part.
As do I. So the resolution asserting, obviously, that there is not just a problem with anti-Semitism, but also with Islamophobia by name, and indeed goes on for approximately two pages to talk about the risks of Islamophobia and the awfulness of Islamophobia. And it was so favorable to Omar that she managed to turn around what should have been a sanction against her as an anti-Semitic congresswoman and actually parlayed this into the appearance of a victory by saying, the accusation of dual loyalty, there's really a post 9/11 condition faced by Muslim Americans, and really we are suffering vicious attacks, went on to make the statement that this was the first time in American history that we have voted on a resolution condemning anti-Muslim bigotry. And I can't help but laugh, Mort, because truly what should have been a slam dunk, which should have been an opportunity for the Democrats to say, this is a moment where we can stand together unified and say anti-Semitism will not flourish in our ranks, was so vacuous enough as to present a platform for Representative Omar to actually portray it as a victory. So we call, I call these 23 GOP House members who abstained the brave 23. One of them, Representative Andy Biggs from Arizona's 5th Congressional District, had something particularly compelling to say. Listen in.
Democratic leaders have attempted to rationalize and protect this individual, saying, quote, she did not understand the full weight of the words, close quote. One wonders what more needs to be done to try to eradicate anti-Semitism from this body. Some have said that to specifically condemn these statements and to remove her from her committee assignments would stifle legitimate criticism of Israel. But the problem with that argument is this. The comments made were not directed at Israel, were not directed to policy, were not directed towards the American-Israel relationship. They were instead directed to Americans with the allegation that they have a dual loyalty, which is an ancient anti-Semitic cliche that has been used to target the Jewish community throughout history.
My guest today has been Mort Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America. Mort, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. I feel the fire in your belly as it is in ours, and we are condemning this resolution that should have been very clear, very specific. Thanks for being with us today. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry. Up next, in an unprecedented move, an Alabama judge allows a teen father to sue an abortion mill on behalf of his aborted baby. I will talk to Brent Helms, the young man's attorney, coming up next.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
The world on our horizon isn't like the days I knew. Gone are the days of writing with fresh ink on thick paper and the swift crack of a letter opener. Homemade meals now replaced by fancy robots trying to figure out how often I buy organic goji berries. I don't even know what a goji berry is. My church started offering free Wi-Fi and changed their name from First Baptist to Radiant Water Life something or other. They even started posting video sermons recorded on wood pallet backgrounds that sync directly to a Dropbox that I have yet to locate. Thankfully, there's a silver lining to all this newfangled technology. Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. Put down your quill and contact your legislators directly from your smartphone or tablet. Share legislative alerts with your contacts and connect with like-minded Christians about the latest current events. Read the Washington Update and listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. This thing's got it all, buddy boy. Keep your cool and help secure our future at frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for FRC Action. Well, a teenager in Alabama is suing an abortion clinic for terminating the life of his unborn child against his wishes. And if this suit sounds very interesting, novel, and unique, you would be right. It is the first of its kind. On Tuesday, an Alabama county court recognized the aborted fetus, Baby Roe, as a co-plaintiff in the lawsuit, making it, again, a groundbreaking development in the case for life nationwide. My guest is Brent Helms today, the attorney for the baby's estate and father. Brent, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you.
So, Brent, tell me a little bit about the story of your client. Your client, Ryan Magers, is 19 years old, and his girlfriend went to get an abortion. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened on that day itself and what's progressed since then?
Sure. Even before the abortion, Ryan was opposed. He pleaded with his girlfriend not to go get the abortion. She did get the abortion. After that, of course, the relationship between the two deteriorated. And he decided that he didn't want any other father to have to go through what he went through. And so it's his goal at this time to make sure that that happens. No father has to go through it again.
So I want our listeners to listen in on a quick soundbite from Ryan directly. Ryan, who is the plaintiff in this case, had this to say.
I believe that every child from conception is a baby and it deserves to live. I'm here for the men who actually want to have their baby.
So Alabama recognizes the personhood of a fetus, and that was a result of Amendment 2, which was a constitutional amendment that was overwhelmingly passed by voters in Alabama during the midterm election season of 2018. It is the only one of two states. My understanding is it's also West Virginia, who has now a constitutional amendment that narrowly passed recognizing personhood. What do you think this says about the trend nationwide in these states who are taking on the cause of abortion, both pro and anti in their state legislatures and in the voting booths going forward? Do you think we'll see more of this?
I do. I think it's obviously we have polar opposites. I mean, you're pro-choice or you're not. And those who are pro-life are trying to take a stand as best they can. And this lawsuit obviously helps that.
So you have written that the time is ripe for consistency in Alabama's jurisprudence. Either you fully acknowledge the personhood of the unborn, or we cherry pick which innocents we protect and those we trash for profit, which I think is an extremely eloquent addressing of what seems to be a consistent issue. In fact, we're seeing more of this at the federal level in that Democrats are unwilling to yield even on the basics of scientific research indicating viability outside the womb, threshold and experiencing of pain, when a heartbeat is available, what the developmental stages are. So we're not seeing a lot of give, certainly, at the federal level. And in some of these states, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, New York, we are seeing particularly aggressive pro-abortion measures. So if we're taking this from a state law perspective and assuming Roe has the potential to be overturned, for the non-lawyers among us, and you and I understand the law, but if the Supreme Court takes up a case that will effectively undo Roe versus Wade, what is the impact for the rest of the states?
Well, I think if we overturn Roe v. Wade, then it's that decision as to whether abortion is going to be legal or not will be returned to the states. And in addition to that, that's why it's so important that you elect representatives that are going to vote in accordance with your beliefs, because essentially it's going to be those individuals who are making the law in your state.
Can you tell us a little bit, Brent, about where the case stands now procedurally? You have filed the complaint, as I understand it, and where does this move forward from here?
Sure. It's unique because we were able to open an estate for an aborted unborn child. And so now not only is Ryan able to sue, but he's all in his capacity as a father, but he's also able to sue on behalf of his unborn aborted child. So we've got two plaintiffs, Ryan and him acting on behalf of his unborn child. What we have right now is a waiting period. We're waiting for opposing counsel to respond. They have to respond on or before April 1st. And once we receive their response, then obviously we'll have an opportunity to respond to their response to us.
Do you think this case has the makings of a legal challenge that could make it eventually to the Supreme Court? Is that your anticipation, or do you think that's something that we probably won't see with this particular case?
You know, I don't know. This is the first case of its kind. Certainly, if it did make it to the Supreme Court, we would follow it all the way. Ryan is very vigorously fighting for rights of fathers and also, importantly, the rights of unborn children. And so if there is an opportunity for us to create new law that would impact the United States as a whole, we certainly want to do that.
Were you surprised when the probate judge allowed Meggers to name his aborted child as a co-plaintiff? Was that something you were anticipating?
Yes, we were anticipating that. We, in the state of Alabama, our Supreme Court has had seven rulings in the past 8 years wherein a child, an unborn child, has been deemed a person. And so also with the passage of Amendment 2, I actually commend the judge for following the law. He's not an activist. In all 67 counties in the state of Alabama right now, I believe if the same petition was filed by law, it would have to be granted, because that the Alabama Supreme Court is binding all of those probate courts in the state of Alabama.
Well, not surprisingly, president of the National Abortion Rights Action League has called this a very scary case. Anytime pro-abortionists are happy, unhappy, we know that we are headed in the right direction. So we thank you, Brent, for what you are doing for this young man. We'll be watching the case very carefully. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry. Coming up next, the California Department of Veterans Affairs is threatening to evict an 84-year-old widow from a veteran's home unless she halts a longtime Bible study she's been leading for fellow residents. I'll talk with Brad Dacus, president of Pacific Justice Institute, next.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy that inspire us from childhood, such as unicorns and the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being, from the Loch Ness Monster to big tax refunds. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. Since 1973, these abortion myths have grown a substantial foothold in developing a climate of fear, misinformation, and a culture of death in the United States. In FRC's new analysis, learn whether most Americans support abortion on demand, and if a fetus does in fact feel pain in the womb. Join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. Officials with the California Department of Veterans Affairs are evicting an 84-year-old widow from the Veterans Home of California in Yountville, where she has lived for 9 years. She has to halt, according to the Department of Veterans Affairs, longtime Bible studies she has been leading for fellow elderly residents. And the man who is going to help me get to the bottom of this story today is my friend Brad Dacus, president of the Pacific Justice Institute, which is representing the widow, Artis Breaux. Brad, welcome to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be on the program. Appreciate it.
So, Brad, can you tell us a little bit about the widow herself? Because they ended up in the veteran's home because of an extensive record of service by the husband. And I want to hear a little bit about the personal background, because it is really like something out of a movie.
Yeah, you're right. She's a really wonderful lady. She's an 84-year-old widow, and she's living in the California veteran's home. She's for a long time. She's had Bible studies there. And has actually been, helping to minister to those there. She's been a volunteer chaplain in that capacity as well. She's actually, served our country. She and her husband, moved to Veteran Homes about 9 years ago. But her husband had served as a merchant marine in World War II, served in the famed 82nd Airborne Division overseas. And then served in the Air Force during the Korean War. Meanwhile, Artis, this woman, has also worked as a civilian employee in the office of the Chief of Staff of the Army at the Pentagon during the Korean War. So it's about serving their country, defending freedom. That's been the heart of her and her husband and the sacrifice. And she still wants to serve and has been serving so faithfully and wonderfully for quite some time there at the California home in Yountville, California.
So she had been volunteering with the chaplaincy program and leading Bible studies for many years in a part of the residence known as the Holderman Building. Now, this is a shared space portion of the veterans home. Does the fact that she has been holding these Bible studies in a shared space, a common area that others use, does that present problems legally for her case?
It really doesn't, because even still, no one is compelled to sit in on that group. They can sit in another part of the room. They can be in that room at another time. No one is compelled to have to be in that Bible study. And that's the real distinction here, is that anyone participating in the Bible study is there because they want to be there.
So artists began encountering opposition last September when the home was claiming that a discussion between herself and another resident about heaven and hell allegedly caused him to lose sleep and therefore constituted elder abuse, emotional abuse, and was otherwise illegal activity, which seems to me a pretty extreme reaction. I'm assuming that was also your response to that claim.
Yes, it is. I mean, people have had discussions of heaven and hell and eternal life, and you know, it's not a normal response for someone to have sleeplessness and emotional duress. You know, that's just like, you know, what's being complained about. It's obviously, in our opinion, it's been you know, dressed and souped up for the purpose of having her halt her ability to have a Bible study there. We at Pacific Justice Institute have defended Bible studies before, and we've seen these kinds of tactics before. But just assuming on its face that this person was upset, it's still not grounds to silence a Bible study. Those people living in that home, you know, these veterans living in this California veterans home, you know, they've served their country. They are there. They should not be deprived the ability of having their spiritual needs met, and that's why we have chaplains in the military. And that's why we should be able to, and this woman should be able to continue having her Bible study without being shut down, much less evicted, because that's what we're looking at now. They are threatening her with eviction. This elderly widow, 84 years old, thrown out, that is totally unreasonable and outrageous, and we at Pacific Justice Institute are representing her and have expressed our legal opinion on the matter to that entity.
And as of today's date, you have yet to receive a response about a request for an interview. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And, you know, we had a very strongly worded response to the state of California on just this last Friday. And so about a week ago, we're weighing all the legal options, and we are representing her and to make sure that that she's going to be defended and protected fully and completely under the law and under the Constitution.
As you've so eloquently put, this is a rather shocking attack from the state against the free exercise of religion, and she is really not just fighting for herself and for the single Bible study, but really fighting for those who are unable for themselves to fight against the state's attempted intimidation. My friend Brad Dacus, president of Pacific Justice Institute, has been our guest. You are listening to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry. Coming up next, I will talk with a former California public school educator, Rebecca Friedrichs, who is horrified by the state's sex ed curriculum, calling it pornographic and highly biased. Wait till you hear what it includes. We'll be right back.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Myth and folklore have influenced our civilization for centuries. Some of these myths can be wondrous tales of fantasy, from unicorns to the ever-beloved elf on a shelf. Others, however, can be detrimental to our well-being. Today, the myths surrounding abortion have become part of such vexations that plague our society. In FRC's analysis, 10 Myths on Abortion, join us as we debunk these myths and find the truth to secure a future for the culture of life. Visit frc.org/myths.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to our other free resources, go to frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. On Tuesday, fed-up California parents protested the state's sex ed curriculum, calling it pornographic, age-inappropriate, highly biased, and medically inaccurate instruction. My next guest, Rebecca Friedrichs, has been on both sides of the debate, a former California educator, 28 years worth of former California educating. She agrees with their concerns and has written a book entitled Standing Up to Goliath, Battling State and National Teachers Unions for the Heart and Soul of Our Kids and Country. Rebecca, I am very excited to have you today on Washington Watch.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
So, Rebecca, this is a sweet spot for me. I have three kids in public education, and boy, I tell you what, it has gotten harder and harder to be a parent of public school children. And honestly, yeah, this particular story does not make it any easier for me. So I want to talk a little bit about this California sex ed curriculum. So it brought to mind for me sort of the movements in which I was raised. I was raised by what you would call activist conservative parents. I am now one of those parents. In fact, I am meeting with my daughter's health educator on Monday to review their sex ed curriculum. Yes, I am that parent. I am sure you also have been that parent.
Yep.
But the informed parents of California sent an open letter to lawmakers, to principals, State Board of Education, objecting to this particular education. Now, we know sex ed is in schools, but tell me exactly how bad this particular curriculum is.
Well, the first thing I have to say is if any of your listeners have children in the room, they need to remove them. That's
yes,
how bad
agreed.
This curriculum is. Yeah. So what happened here in California, and the reason informed parents of California, which are these wonderful parents who are just trying to protect their children, the reason they're fighting back is because a law was passed in California in 2015, became official January 1st, 2016, and that law, AB 329, has opened the door for curriculums that truly are medically inaccurate and age inappropriate. So I know we're on the radio waves, so to be honest with you, there's a lot I cannot even share on the radio. It's that bad, but I'll give some highlights. Children, teachers like myself are being told that we have to instruct small children, we're talking 11, 12, 13-year-old children, in the use of multiple types of birth control options.
Right.
So number one, telling children to use a condom for anal sex, there's a medical inaccuracy right there because there is no condom approved. These kids could end up with HIV, be seriously ill. We're told to make sex very casual. I've read these curriculums. We're basically telling the kids to sleep around. So this is a really good way to end up with all kinds of diseases that can actually shorten your life or keep you from having children in the future. These are serious issues. We're also told to instruct these children that at age 12, they can go to a clinic. We are instructed to tell them where to find these clinics, and they can obtain birth control, including abortion, without parental knowledge or parental permission. This is serious encroachment on parental authority, and in my opinion, attacks on Judeo-Christian values.
So I'm first of all having to pick my jaw up off the floor, but I find it very interesting that this really is not basic medical instruction on pubescent development as would be appropriate for 11, 12, 13-year-olds. And I have a 12-year-old who will be 13 in a few months. So this is, again, right in exactly the arena in which I am dealing. It is not just those aggressively free sex, anti-parents' rights notions, but also it sounds to me from what I've read that this is a vehicle for the trans cult to work its way into public education as well. And of course, the notion of gender identity, sexual fluidity, this is now the left's sacred cow. In fact, we can't even attack it using legitimate, longstanding biological reality without coming across as bigots. Is there some of that in this curriculum?
There's all of that in this curriculum. And so the reason for me, as I taught public schools for 28 years and actually sued the teachers' unions to stop them from forcing all of us to pay union dues. Why? Because it's the teachers' unions, shockingly, who are funding all of this, who are lobbying for all of this, who are working together with all of these different organizations that are pushing all these gender ideologies to literally push this into our public school classrooms. I think that's totally inappropriate, and teachers have no idea they're funding this stuff. So this is why I wrote this book and why I sued the unions. I have three chapters in the book about the sex ed. It's shocking. So to answer specifically about the gender ideology, yes, here in California, and this is being pushed nationwide and has been pushed through the UN for about 20 years now, teachers' unions are behind it with many others, we are now teaching our children that this could be from preschool, by the way. The gender ideology, parents cannot opt out of the gender ideology, can show up as young as preschool. They're telling our children, hey, look, when you were born, your parents didn't know if you were a boy or a girl, so they assigned a gender to you, and you'll eventually figure out your gender based on this ever-growing spectrum of genders. I've seen as many as 70. I've heard a teacher in my town is teaching 37. It's shocking stuff. And how does the union get away with this? Well, they have rewritten the scientific method. So they crossed out the most important parts of the scientific method, like empirical evidence and experimentation.
Sure.
And they've changed it. They've changed it to theory. And so this is what they do. They twist things, and then they bring in things that are not scientific fact, are not even biologically true. And then when we all push back on it, they call us haters. And they are working hand in hand with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
They are.
And you can go on teacher union websites, and you can click directly, and you can, if you're a child or someone on a campus, and someone dares to say, "I believe marriage is between a man and a woman," or dares to say, "I believe there are two genders," you can actually report them as a hater.
Well, I do know. I do know, having done a little research now with three kids who are advancing through public schools. I have one headed into high school, one in middle school, and one in grade school. So I'm spread out all across the board. Mm-hmm. I do understand how close that nexus is between the teachers' unions and left-wing activist organizations. But you wrote a fabulous op-ed on this movement, specifically this sort of interrelationship between teachers' unions and activist left-wing organizations. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think there are some people who may hear the word union and think, okay, these are organizations that are dedicated toward driving meaningful reform, pay raises. They don't understand fully that there is an activist socialist agenda being pushed behind this. So examine that relationship a little bit for us.
Yeah, I could talk about that all day. So that is the problem. One of the things I tell people all the time is the unions have become what they used to fight. So when I say union, people think, I love the union. Why are you picking on my union? They're my friend. We're not talking about your grandfather's union. We're not talking about an organization that comes in and helps you with what they do, supposedly help us with wages and all of that. But what they're really doing is using hundreds of millions of dollars funded by teachers who think the unions are there to protect them on the job, and they're spending the money to push a far-left social, sexual, and political agenda. Mm. In my book, I have dozens of stories of teachers who've served up at the national levels of the National Education Association, state levels, California Teachers Association, and the other state teachers unions. And when you go to these conferences, I've been to them myself, it's all politics. It's all sex. All they talk about is sex. And it's shocking. Teachers can get thousands of dollars to start a gay straight alliance club on their campus. Can I get some money to help me, you know, with the kids who want, I don't know, a Girl Scouts group on campus? No.
Wow.
But you can get a lot of money if you're pushing their agenda. The teachers union is involved constantly with the Women's March, Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street. Anytime you see an angry march or an angry, divisive, anything dividing by race, dividing by religion, dividing by money, that's the teachers union. They're behind it. They're writing the talking points.
Wow. So I even, as in reading your OC Register op-ed back in January of this month, I even see you mention Antifa as part of this nexus between the teachers' unions and this sort of angry activist mob mentality. In fact, I think a lot of us will remember the visuals of this Red for Ed education movement, right? So the teacher strikes nationwide and the sea of red marching up to the State House to demand equality, to demand higher pay raises, to demand more benefits. And for the casual observer, including my own children, with whom I watch the news and we discuss every night, and they will hate me as they get older. We had a discussion, and my youngest said, oh, this is really great. They're getting more money, thinking it is simplistically just a question of activating for teachers' pay and benefit increases. And there is no question teachers are unsung heroes. I am the daughter of an educator. My mother-in-law is a lifelong educator. We love our teachers. But there is a bigger risk behind all of this. And to say that we are really being bamboozled by the left-wingers who are partnering wisely, and why wouldn't you? Because you have access to the fertile minds of the next generation who are your captive audience, in which you can use a teacher's podium as a bully pulpit. This must have been infuriating for you to experience when you were an active full-time educator.
Yeah, well, and I got to tell you, it's infuriating for most teachers. For me, at least I saw the truth. I got involved and I figured it out that they were using us to push an agenda. Most teachers are these sweet and loving people who just want to teach, and they're being used to push an agenda, and they have no idea. So they're always on the defense. They're mad at people like me. What do you mean? What? So it's not, most teachers are not teaching this stuff in their classrooms. What the unions have done is over the last 50 years, they have carefully planted activists into every level of education, on school boards, administrations, in classrooms. Those activists bully everybody else. So you have all these loving teachers who are just bullied every day. All they want to do is teach. So you mentioned Red for Ed. I wrote another editorial called Red for Ed, Grassroots Movement or Union Propaganda. It's 100% union propaganda. Mm-hmm. I am friends with one of the teachers who helped start Red for Ed in Arizona. Her name's Catherine. Catherine believed Red for Ed was all about raises for teachers, so she got involved as a union leader. Then her spidey senses went off when she figured out that once they got the raise, the unions started attacking the governor of Arizona, and they morphed Red for Ed into Invest in Ed, and they pushed to raise taxes on all Arizonans and started bullying the governor. And she said they didn't even say thank you to him. She's a good, loving teacher. She wants to go say thanks and do the right thing. So she realized we're all being used to push an agenda. So now she fights against it with me. And so Red for Ed, there are teachers who've been at those teacher strikes, and Antifa is there at the strikes. And they're busing in activists from Chicago to mix in with these teachers and bully them. And then the leader of Red for Ed, a teacher named Noah, I can't remember his last name, only taught for a couple years. They teach a couple years, and they get in there, and they seem like a real teacher, but they're activists pushing an agenda.
Okay, Rebecca, I am almost out of time. I have one question for you. So this proposed health education framework is set to be adopted in May by the State Board of Education. So what can these parents do who are listening in California? What can they do to put the brakes on this curriculum?
Yeah, well, the Informed Parents of California that you mentioned earlier is busing up to the state capitol in California on March 28th and 29th. And they will be picketing against that health framework, because on that day there's a committee meeting about the framework. So they're going to be up there picketing so parents can show up that day, March 28th or 29th, and then they can just start flooding the California Department of Ed with emails and letters against this framework. We sent in a couple thousand, and they've ignored us. So the more, the better. Just putting the pressure
more, the
on
better.
The teachers. Yeah, the teachers' unions and their friends lobby 24/7.
Rebecca Friedrichs, I've got to let you go. You have been a phenomenal guest. This is a passion issue. Go to For Kids and Country. This is Rebecca's organization. Get more information there. You can also find the podcast of today's broadcast and more information about her program, TonyPerkins.com. Follow Tony at T Perkins. Thank you.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.